Coming up, we got Mark Titus talking about March Madness, one of the most epic comebacks we've ever seen with UConn taking down Duke. But first, I've got some thoughts on Adam Silver and the NBA's concepts they put out there for NBA lottery reform. Let's talk about NBA lottery reform, because last Wednesday, Adam Silver walked up to the podium and said, "We are going to fix it, full stop." Full stop! That made me almost spit out my smoothie, because that's not the incrementalist, as Adam Silver has described himself. That's the commissioner who, 2 months into his tenure, banned an owner for life. That's the Silver who means business, and that's the leader we need to fix tanking. And it made me incredibly excited about what it means for lottery reform. And then what happened the next day? The NBA leaked three concepts that have been met with confusion, negativity, and skepticism that the mechanics don't actually solve what they're trying to supposed to solve. I think the negative reaction to all of this isn't really about any specific concept. It's more a confidence problem. All season, rhetoric kept escalating. Speeches were made about competitive integrity. Fines were handed out to Indiana and Utah as warning shots. And then when the moment finally arrived, what happened was another workshop session. And from what I understand talking to sources around the league, these three concepts are a collage of ideas drawn from conversations. Conversations with the competition committee, front offices, and ownership groups. And these ideas can be combined, tweaked, stripped for parts. Nothing's locked in. So the three concepts you saw Shams Charania report from the NBA leak, that's really just pieces, and that's why they're called concepts and not proposals. I find it easier to think about these concepts as individual levers the league is deciding whether to pull. So here's what's on the table. The NBA could flatten the odds. It's currently 14% for the three worst records, and concept number one suggested 8% flat for the bottom 10 teams. The PA responded to that. They said it should be 7%, but every concept reduces that number, making the lottery even more random. The NBA wants to draw more picks. The league currently draws just the top four picks, moving up from three as it was before. These concepts float drawing up to 18 picks, though my sources say that's an extreme number. It's just a placeholder. And I'd expect something higher than four, but well below 18. It could be six. Could be 8, could be 12. We'll see once they actually finally make the proposal in May. The NBA wants to expand the pool of teams. Currently, it's 14 teams. The NBA could go to 18 teams by including the play-in teams, or it could go to 22 teams by including first-round playoff losers. And it could also just stay at 14, according to my sources, because if teams push back and they don't want to add the play-in winners or playoff losers in the first round, that very well might be the case with what happens. They've suggested two-year record averaging. This is what the WNBA model looks like. It smooths out single season tanking by factoring in the prior year record. And concept number two had this suggestion, and it also had something with a win floor. So basically, if a team finishes below a certain win total, such as 25 wins, you get credited with that higher number. So this would remove the incentive for teams to just be catastrophically bad, a 9-win team, a 12-win team, because it would mean you're credited with 25 wins for the win floor. And then they've also suggested a double lottery concept. So concept number three had something called the 5x5, where the first five picks get drawn and then the next five picks, and the teams with the five worst records couldn't fall below 10th in their example. And one of the things that I had questions about with the 5x5 as well, wait a minute, like teams, wouldn't they just try to tank into the bottom five if they can only fall as far as 10? That seems like what would happen next. And what I've been told, according to sources within the league office and from teams, is that the NBA has talked about randomizing the floor. So even with the current odds, so currently this year, the 14% flattened odds, you still have the Pacers and the Wizards and these teams fighting for the worst record, because with the worst record, the worst pick you can receive still matters. The worst record can fall to fifth at worst. That's the worst case scenario for them on lottery night, while the third worst record can fall to seventh and the fourth worst record to eighth and so on. So Sources in the league office and from team front offices have been saying that the NBA is weighing a mechanism to randomize those positions with the bottom group. That way, the fourth worst team could end up with the best odds within that group. And individually, I think these concepts all make sense. And I've played around with assembling a proposal myself, like the NBA basically did with the three concepts they put out there. I've thought, maybe you expand to 22 teams and draw 10 picks in the 5x5 format, and you flatten the odds and you randomize the positioning for which picks teams can drop to. And you can't explain it. It's just like you need a whole paragraph to explain the lottery. You can't say it in one or two sentences. And if you can't do that, then what are we really doing? You know, if any of these three concepts the NBA proposed or some combination that they end up putting to a vote to teams in May, it's looking like it's going to be something where people just say when they're watching the draft lottery, or maybe they don't even tune in, they watch it and say, wake me up when we know the order. Because it's just too confusing to understand. And it can't be that. The NBA draft lottery needs to be a massive event. It can't be something that creates confusion with people while it's happening. And that's the whole issue people really have with the NBA. Reviews take too long. They're too complicated. The NBA Cup has games on one night, not on the other night. The season drags on too long. You can't turn on a game and know who's playing because of all the alternate jerseys. It's just all too much, all too confusing for a lot of people. And so, to Adam Silver, I'd say this. You need to make the lottery simple, and you need to own it. You got to put your name on it. Collaboration, I respect it, but in this case, you got to make it yours. And it's got to be something that can be explained in one simple sentence or two simple sentences. For example, here's one idea that I've had that's one sentence. The NBA draft lottery draws 10 picks, and the teams that miss the playoffs get 6% odds at the number one pick, while the teams that lose in the first round get 2% odds at the number one pick. One sentence, easy to understand. You might not like it, but you get it, right? And in that case, the odds are flattened and they're smoothened. There's no reason to bottom out. You could randomize the floor so those teams at the bottom aren't incentivized to be the worst. And there's no reason to tank out of the playoffs because when your odds move from only 2% to 6%, it's not a dramatic increase. It's like going from the 11th best odds to the 8th best odds under the current system. And I think that'd be like maximum level excitement for basically 2/3 of the league to tune into, making draft lottery night an event, a big product. And that's the thing I think Adam Silver does realize, because the nature of the NBA season is that it's about volume, not events. It's a volume product. And that's what the NBA Cup was created for. It's an event. That's why the play-in tournament was created. It's an event. And so I think that's what the NBA draft lottery needs to become. It has to be an event. And that's why for years, if you're a listener of my podcast, you know I've said the NBA needs to also let the top three seeds in every conference choose their first round opponent. The NBA playoff draft. Can you imagine that if OKC was choosing their first round playoff opponent this year? That'd be crazy. So that's beside the point, but I might as well throw it in there. I understand why fans might push back on the idea of letting play-in teams or playoff teams into the lottery. We already saw earlier this season when the Clippers sucked what people were saying. Well, what if OKC gets number one and a chance to get Peterson or DeBounce or a Boozer? And what if a number one seed or a number two seed lost in the first round if the NBA did have first round losers as part of the lottery? That like almost never happens. It just doesn't happen. Over the last 25 years, top two seeds have won 93% of their first round series. Three seeds have won 78% of their first round series. So it's a low statistical probability that the top seed is upset and they move up in the draft. With that prior idea I had with 2% for first round losers, it's like a 1 in 740 chance that it's if one or two seed loses in the first round and moves into get the number one pick. It's just highly unlikely. So nothing's perfect. That's just the reality of it. That's why the NBA has changed the lottery rules time and time again over the last 35 years. I just think at the end of the day, with where the league is today, the league needs to incentivize winning, trying, competitiveness. And that's for the fans because, you know, it's not as if having the number one or the number two or the number three pick guarantees you a star. It increases the likelihood. Like, that's where the Victor Wembanyama and the LeBron James types are found. But it's not a certainty. Like, last year's All-NBA teams, Jokic, 41st pick, Giannis, 15th, Jalen Williams, 12th, SGA, 11th, Halliburton, 12th, Mitchell, 13th, Brunson, 33rd, Steph, 7th. 10 years ago, 2014-15 season prior to that one, Marc Gasol, 48th, Boogie, 5th, DeAndre Jordan, 35th, Steph, 7th, Clay, 11th. 10 years before that, Amare Stoudemire, 9th, Ben Wallace, undrafted. Three guys were picked 9th, Sean Marion, Dirk, T-Mac. Gilbert Arenas went 31st, Steve Nash, 15th, Kobe, 13th. NBA teams understandably tank for the chance at number one. And they're not just tanking for the chance at number one, they're tanking for that floor to hopefully get the 5th pick or the 6th pick rather than the 12th, 13th, or 14th pick. But the obsession with the top pick has always been more psychological than statistical. The draft has never been a guarantee. History has been littered with franchise-altering players who fell, who went undrafted, were found in the second round, and there's been plenty of busts who went first or second or third who were in the league and then they disappeared. Like, teams are tanking for certainty in a process that's never been certain. The draft has never been certain. It's always random. And if the new lottery system introduces more randomness, I say so be it. As long as the process is simple, worth watching, and most importantly, it minimizes the chances that a team is intentionally trying to lose games, and that harms the integrity of the sport. That's the position we're in right now today. And with expansion likely coming, possibly for the 28-29 season, that means we're going to have the 2027 NBA draft next year with new rules. And then the 2028 draft, I'd imagine, will incorporate one or two expansion teams. So whatever they do this year, it really only needs to be a literal one-year experiment. Like, test it out. It's not like reform hasn't happened a ton of times already. Test something out this one year, and then you automatically have to change it assuming expansion happens, tweaking it. It's not like the NBA hasn't tinkered already a ton of times. They had equal odds in 1985, weighted odds in 1990, the ping pong machine and 25% top odds in 1994, the flattened 14% reform in 2019, which has not helped. Each fix created the next problem, and maybe this one will too, but Adam Silver, at least, please make it one that people can understand while it's happening. Just please fix it. Full stop. We'll talk about the NBA more later in the week because, I mean, it was an interesting weekend while all eyes were on college basketball. Tatum finally had a breakout performance. He looked excellent against the Hornets, looked like himself. Sixers getting healthy. Two big back-to-back performances by Joel Embiid. I'm not quitting Philly. I mean, I'm not ruling them out getting to the conference finals. Winning the finals, that's a bit much. 3 months of healthy Joel Embiid. But we'll talk about that later in the week. And by the way, the Raptors, 31-0 run against the Magic. It's not going to shock me this week if we hear some Jamal Mosley hot seat stuff coming out. It wouldn't shock me at all. That's going to be on Thursday. We're going to have a huge NBA episode with Tom Haberstra. But today we're talking about college basketball, why these teams are tanking in the first place with a interesting weekend of March Madness. And that's going to happen with my old friend, Mark Titus.
We'll be right back.
Mark, how are you, man?
I'm doing great, Kev. Good to see your face. It's been a while. I love that we still keep in touch. I love that we're still doing this. I love that you're growing out the beard and it looks good. I love everything about this, Kevin.
I love everything about this as well, Mark. Look, up until UConn Duke, there's three blowouts. It wasn't the best Elite Eight weekend. And then we got one of the greatest comebacks we've seen. Duke blows a 19-point lead on Sunday, six turnovers in the final 10 minutes. And then on the final play, they throw the ball away. Alex Caravan grabs it, goes to Braylon Mullins, who was 10 for his last 58 from three, and he hits the shot. and madness. Like, it was just, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. What shocked you the most from that blown lead the whole final 10 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, what was crazy to me was, like, I didn't really feel like UConn played that well in coming back. I mean, they weren't bad, obviously. They erased a 19-point lead, and you have to play decently well to do that, of course. But this was not a case of, like when you compare Duke's choke last year against Houston to this one, I felt like last year Houston kind of seized it. Houston kind of, like, that was sort of the thing with Houston basketball last season, was they would never die. They're down six or something with less than a minute, and Houston just is never out of the game. So last year when Duke choked, it was a little bit of Duke choking, but it was also like, man, this Houston team just will not die. Whereas this one was just Duke choking. This was just like UConn's final possession before the shot. They have like 30 seconds left. They're coming out down three and they just dribble around for 18 seconds. They have no real plan. They get fouled on the perimeter. They hit one of the free throws. There's just a lot of like I didn't even really feel like UConn played that well, which makes it almost even funnier. It makes it like the circumstances that led to Duke losing are insane. It makes no sense. But yeah, I mean, UConn obviously did play well enough to put themselves in that position. But you said it, Braylon Mullins could not hit anything all night, has not been particularly great this tournament. Alex Caravan, the familiar face on UConn, if you've been watching UConn basketball the last few years, the senior leader, he couldn't hit anything, but like with about a minute left and they were down, I think four at the time, he hits a big three, which was his only made three of the night.
That three was, filthy. That three, just coming off the curl, like just awesome, awesome shot.
UConn played poorly for about 36, 37 minutes, something like that. I mean, obviously I'm overstating it. Terrace Reed was great for UConn all night. You know, the defense really tightened up in the second half for UConn and they were just chipping away at it. But this was an all-time game, an all-time shot, and it's the reason why March Madness is the best, man. As a college hoops fan, like, I do feel like there were a lot of discussions about this tournament, about how, like, the magic of March is dying, the Cinderellas are dying. You said it, Kevin, you know, there were three blowouts in the Elite Eight. We were setting up for a fourth, and I think this is kind of what the tournament needed, a little shot in the arm to remind everybody that, like, not every game is going to be a banger. But the reason you watch this tournament is because any game could be a banger, you know, and that's what this was. You could not. I feel bad for the people that turned this game off because it did feel like that's where it was headed. Duke was up 19. Turn it off. You'll check in on Saturday for the Final Four. And those people are going to be very confused as to why UConn is playing on Saturday.
I mean, I think, like, I totally understand if someone shuts the game off because it was the type of thing, time to watch our Sunday shows, right? Like, time to move on with our day. That's what it was starting to feel like. It's a blowout. It's over. This weekend was disappointing. And then, obviously, UConn storms back. I do think you're underselling how well UConn played down the stretch, though. I mean, six live ball turnovers by Duke. Those aren't just all caused by themselves. Like, UConn was flying around on defense, really aggressive, fighting over screens, and you got to give that team credit, from Dan Hurley, the head coach, to the team themselves, down 19 to keep playing with that intensity the way in which they did. I was really impressed. I mean, for them to sustain
I'm with
that.
You. I'm with you. I mean, lesser teams would have packed it in. Lesser teams would have quit. I mean, obviously, I was overstating it. And I'm looking at it more from the laughing at Duke angle than anything else. So, like, that's my perspective on it. But, yeah, I mean, I just felt like some of those live ball turnovers are just head-scratching decisions. And then, like, I mean, there was one with, like, 2 minutes left or something where Solo Ball picks off a Cam Boozer pass, and then Boozer fouls him for an and one. And just like that play, you're just like, what are you doing? How are you the best player in the country? And this is what you're doing. In UConn, I mean, it's like the reason I was saying that too is, like, UConn could not hit anything. They start 1-for-18 from the 3-point line. They go 4-for-5 from three in their final five attempts, including a half court shot or just inside a half court. So, you're right. I mean, credit to UConn. There's no doubt about that. And you can't beat the number one overall seed being down 19 by playing poorly. It was just like, honestly, if you're going to ask me in 5, 10, 20 years or whatever, what I remember about this game, I'm going to start with Duke choking more so than, like, UConn being unbelievable down the stretch.
Kevin Sweeney from Sports Illustrated made a post showing Duke's last four losses, their win probability, the peak win probability in those games. Final four last year against Houston was 97.5%. Against Texas Tech in December, 97.8%. In February against North Carolina, 95.1%. And then against UConn last night, it was 98.5%. 0.7%, and this is becoming a trend at this point with Duke. They blow a 14-point lead to Houston last year, up 6 with 40 seconds to go. Sion James can't inbound the ball. This is a kind of a thing with these John Shire teams. Is John Shire a bigger disappointment than Hubert Davis?
I mean, it is a thing. It's legitimately a thing, and I don't know what he does to fix it. I don't know how you address it in the offseason. This isn't something, you know, like some coaches will have a team that can't score the basketball, so they're like, all right, we got to focus on this. I got to retool the offense. I got to get some shooters in for next year, or vice versa if it's defense, you know, and like we got to get some rim protection. We got to tweak this and that. I don't know how you tweak, like, what I can only assume is like some sort of mental makeup of John Shire that leads to this. It is legitimately a thing. I don't think this is just like something that like talking heads like us will pick at. This has been a problem for a couple years with Duke. They have an overwhelming talent advantage in just about any game they play in, and they build these leads. They let them evaporate. I don't know what he does from here. I don't know how this doesn't haunt him. It's a legitimate problem, Kevin. And I don't know. Like, he's a better coach than Hubert Davis. I will give credit to John Shire that, like, he's won 70 games in the last 2 years. And it's easy to say he's got all the best players, and it would be easy to do that. But we've seen coaches have stacked teams before and not be as good as he's been in these last 2 years in terms of racking up wins. And to be completely honest, I felt like this Duke team overachieved going into the season what I expected from them. I thought last year's team was historically great. Like, last year's team choking in the Final Four was an all-time moment for me, because I felt like, and we're seeing it now with Knipple and Flagg at the NBA level, it's like this team is absolutely loaded. If they finish the job, I do think, you know, there's an argument to be made that they're a top five-ish team in the history of college basketball. And they obviously didn't. This year's team, I didn't really feel that about. I felt like Cam Boozer was obviously great, is going to win National Player of the Year. He has pieces around him. Isaiah Evans is going to play at the next level. Gongo will probably play at the next level. But like, they didn't really jump off the screen at you as you watch him. It was kind of Cam Boozer just consistently going about his business, guys fitting in around him. As they had injury problems, Isaiah Evans has kind of stepped his game up a little bit. But this, to me, all season, this was not a particularly special Duke team. They just found ways to win. So I was actually in a position going into the game yesterday, and as Duke's going up to build a 19-point lead, I was in a position to like give John Shire his flowers and be like, dude, this is kind of an incredible coaching job he's done this year. And it all evaporated. So I think Shire's a good coach. I think Duke's in a great position. I think like the idea of him getting fired or, you know, maybe he should walk away. Maybe he should try to get an NBA job. I don't, anybody that has like that sort of thought this morning, I think that's off base. But having said that, I do think it's fair to say he has a big game problem, and that he is a choker right now. And you can fix that. I just don't know how you fix that. I don't know where he goes from here.
I mean, look, when the last play, Cameron Boozer inbounds, or Sar inbounds to Cameron Boozer. Boozer passes it, gets doubled, passes it back to Sar. At that point, I was thinking to myself, like, okay, in my brain, Sar is a poor free throw shooter, but he passed it up to Caden Boozer. I was nervous. I was still thinking he would hold the ball in that moment instead of making a risky up court pass. And then Caden Boozer got it. I was almost relieved in the moment for Duke. I almost had a perfect Final Four. I wanted Duke to win to have the perfect Final Four. Caden Boozer gets the ball. I'm thinking he's going to hold it. And he didn't. Yeah. And in that moment, he passes it, and it's a turnover, and it leads to the madness we saw. So all the replays we learn afterwards, we see John Shire on the sideline. He was pointing like, pass it up. And then this morning I saw a clip posted earlier this month that Duke posted all over social media where John Shire was in the locker room showing a video of Trey Jones in the NBA passing the ball up to like waste the final seconds of the clock. And Shire's like, no kidding. What do you do at the end of the game? You pass it up court, or you pass it up in the air. There's a video posted March 6th all over social media that Duke posted. And then Trey Jones is in the clip saying that Duke education. And it's like, no, oh my way. God, this is real. This
no
is
way.
Real.
Send that to me. I got to see that.
This is real. And the fact is Shire, this is situational basketball that he's teaching his team to pass it up in these moments, not hold the ball when you have two guys in front of you building a wall of arms. I can't fathom why Caden Boozer made that pass, and yet I understand why when Shire is instructing his team to play that way. And I think that's a mistake where you're positioning your team to choke when you keep having Cion James inbound the ball last year, where you tell them to do what they did this year by passing the ball up. So it's like, this is self-imposed choking in that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to defend Shire, like I guess Pat, like if he does come, if he gets the ball down to the other two guys, it's game of the clock runs out and Duke wins, you know. So like I guess that's the point. But I don't know why he turned and panicked. I don't know why he jump passed. I don't know why you turn just like all in one motion. He took a dribble and then like tried to jump up, and he's one of the shortest guys on the floor, and he's trying to throw a pass over two defenders with their hands up. If you're gonna make the pass, dribble around the defender and throw it. Like, be certain that you can complete the pass. It was crazy. We on our show last night, Mostly Hoops, the live reaction, we went around the room and just started naming everything that he could have done in that moment that would have been better than what he did do. And I mean, the list is like there are thousands of things. I think if Caden Boozer would have caught the ball and just drop kicked it into the crowd, I think it would have been a better decision than what he did. But I also threw out the idea if Caden Boozer would have turned around and shot at the UConn basket, I think it would have been a better idea. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but like you could, if you're someone that is enjoying this Duke collapse as much as me, I encourage you to do that at home. I encourage you to just get out a notebook and write down all the things they could have done differently that would have led to a win other than just hand the ball back to UConn. It was an all-time game, obviously an all-time shot. I'm doing my best to not get carried away and say it's the best shot I've ever seen in an NCAA tournament game, which I think like people would push back on. But I think if you consider the difficulty of the shot and the stakes equally, there might be an argument that Brendan Mullen's shot was the greatest shot in NCAA tournament history. Now, people will tell you Chris Jenkins' shot was better because it was for the national championship at the buzzer. That was a semi-routine three-point shot. And two, it was a tie game. So I think, like, you know, if you want to factor in, you're down by two. If you make this shot, you win. If you miss it, you lose. Also, with the chaos that ensued before and kind of after, I don't know if you saw the Dan Hurley clips of him on the sideline celebrating. But that was wild.
Dude, Dan Hurley goes nose to nose, forehead
nose
to forehead.
Nose to nose with the ref.
He's such a psycho. He's crazy, kind of a man child, but I love everything about Dan Hurley because he's such a mean person. It's so genuine, though. He's a character. He's a character.
So genuine. And I think that's the difference between him and like a Coach K. Coach K, I absolutely hated. And I hated Coach K because he was a maniac who tried to pretend like he was like this buttoned up leader of men. And like, you know, he's trying to pretend like he's like presidential and like, you know, but like he was actually an insane man. And it was just so inauthentic and it just rubbed me the wrong way. Dan Hurley's crazy. And I understand people that don't like him. And I'll be completely honest. Last year, I didn't like Dan Hurley. I thought Dan Hurley took it too far with some of his antics, some of his comments. He kind of lost his mind in a bad way last year because UConn wasn't very good. But when UConn's good and Dan Hurley's acting like this, it is, I mean, it's authentic. And that's all you really want. Like, love him or hate him, like, that is just who he is. He's ripping his suit jacket off, going face to face with the ref. It's crazy.
It's unbelievable. I mean, one other thing from that final shot. Well, two other things. A, Alex Caravan, in possibly his last college game, deciding to pass the ball to Braylon Mullins. Great decision. I respect that. I think it is indicative of who he's going to be and why he's going to have a long NBA career, because he's a great shooter, but he also makes the right decisions. He plays hard all the time. He's a smart player. And then on the other side of that, the flip side, Isaiah Evans not contesting the shot. I mean, I like Isaiah Evans. I talked him up last week on the show. He had a big game in the Sweet 16. But boy, not getting your hand up in that moment, freezing like a deer in the headlights, that was a bad look. Like, that's just one of those things that's going to stick in my mind when I look at him moving forward in the league. Oh,
that picture on the screen right there is so damning. Just like not even looking at, I mean, he's obviously looking at the clock on the other basket, but
yeah,
you know, he's probably scared to foul, I guess, if you want to argue that, but like you have to get a hand up. You have to, and anyone that's like, that wouldn't have made a difference.
Yeah, scream, wave your arms, do anything, literally anything.
It gives the guy shooting the ball like one more thing to think about in that moment. Just like one more visual cue coming at you. One more, Like, I'm maybe it wouldn't have made a difference, but you got to try something. You can't stand there with your hands below your waist.
You ever see the video of empty high school gyms of kids yelling, "That's my man," at people at the free throw line? He could have at least done that.
Do something, dude. You see, by the way, you see Isaiah Evans. You know what his Instagram handle is? Did you see that?
Oh, I thought I saw that. It turns out it's not real. It turns out
that's not real.
It turns out it's not real. It's not actually his account. I thought
I have bad guys. I have bad guys working for me. I have bad guys working for me.
I thought his name is actually Showtime Slim. So
I gotta fire my guys. I gotta fire my whole team. Nobody takes bait like my team. I woke up to that this morning. Like, my guys were texting me. They're like, "You got to see this." And I was like, "What? All right."
I went to bed to it last night. I posted, "This is insane. How is this even real?" And I woke up real.
Not real.
Not real.
It's the internet, man.
It's not. Well, that game, dude, there's so much fake stuff out there. That's fake videos and everything. Yeah, it's hard not to get tricked nowadays. Something that we got to talk about here. Cameron Boozer, his freshman year, one of the best freshman seasons we've seen. 22.5 points per game, 10.2 boards, 4.1 assists, shot 39% from three, had a excellent advanced stats, 19.1 box plus minus, if you care about that. What are your takeaways from Cam Boozer's freshman year at Duke and what it means for his NBA future?
Yeah, he did. He had a historic freshman season. I think he was an all-time great. I don't know where he ranks in terms of one and dones. I'll leave that to other people that have more time on their hands, I guess. But it was an incredible season. And like I said earlier, I didn't really expect much out of this Duke team in terms of what the standard is at Duke. I didn't really feel like this was going to be a special Duke team. I thought it'd be a good Duke team, which is still, you know, for most programs is they would do anything to ever experience one team that is just considered okay by Duke standards. But that's what I expected for this Duke team. And before last night, and even if you want to factor in last night, they had three losses this year by a combined 5 points. And in all of them, like you said earlier, their win probability was absurd. They were up by 15 plus, I think, in all, or 13 plus. They were up by double digits in all three of their losses. And it's because of him. I mean, Cam Boozer carried the team. He was great at everything. I will say, like, there was a little bit of magic missing from the Cam Boozer season. I'm not really sure why that is. I think his style of play, I think people might find a little boring. It didn't really feel like he was a sensation at the level that, like, Zion obviously was, or even Cooper Flagg last year. Some of these other great one and dones we've seen. I think Cam Boozer was simultaneously flying under the radar, but also was very obviously the national player of the year before January even hit. And I don't know how that computes, that how you can have a guy at Duke who's dominating at the level he is, but yet, like, he's not capturing the public interest that much. But yeah, I think Cam Boozer is going to be obviously very good at the next level. I do think it's an interesting discussion about, like, his style of play, how it will translate. Now, I will say that, like, a lot of his scoring came from, for lack of a better term, I'm not smart enough to find another way to describe it, but it did feel like a little bit of bully ball at times. Like, he's just bigger, stronger, and would, you know, just use his physical advantage to get to the rim. And if he missed, he'd grab the rebound and go up with it. But I do think the reason I like it, and you know, you worry about that at the next level, that, like, he's not going to have that advantage. So how good is he going to be? But I think the reason I really like him is his basketball IQ is off the charts. A lot of teams would go into these games against Duke and say the formula to beat Duke is just throw two guys at Cam Boozer and make the other guys beat you. And they had a very, very rough go, very, very rough go of that, because he's so good at passing out of double teams. He's so good at, like, letting the game come to him and having a great feel. He's a great shooter as well. It feels like every time he was open from three, he'd hit it. He'd step into threes and hit threes, and he just has a great feel for the game. But I do think that, it was fascinating to me, Kev, because he was so, so good all year. His efficiency was off the charts. He's playing at the most notable college basketball program in the country. And for some reason, there was just kind of no magic to this Duke team and to Cam Boozer. I don't know how you measure that or define that, but I just know it to be real as a guy who just lives and breathes college basketball, that, like, this wasn't quite on the level of some of the other one and dones.
I know exactly what you're saying. And I think with Boozer, that's sort of one of the arguments against him, in the sense, like, it's not like an it factor that, like, I think with Peterson, people imagine what he can be. With DiBonta, they imagine what he can be when he's at his best. With Boozer, it's more like, yeah, he'll be Al Horford, he'll be Kevin Love, he'll be a good player. It's almost like there's just no magic behind it. Like, there's no mystery. But at the same time, I do think You mentioned the bully ball. It feels like every time he's in the paint, it's a pump fake in order to create space. Right. And that's where like people have the questions about him in the NBA offensively. I don't. I think he offers enough as a ball handler. We saw him run pick and roll for Duke. He can screen, obviously. He can pick and pop. He can attack off a closeout. He's too versatile. He can be plugged into too many different areas offensively to be something other than something worse than good or even great. I think defensively, this game against UConn was really interesting because nobody could defend Terrace Reed, but Boozer couldn't defend Terrace Reed. He's not big enough. But Boozer, in the final minutes, couldn't stay glued to Alex Caravan on that curl three-pointer with 50 seconds to go where the Caravan hit. He was nowhere close to Caravan on the play. And then the next play, Demery got fouled, kind of blown by Boozer on the perimeter. So I think defensively there are questions about what Cam Boozer can be, which is why having Gongba was so important next to him, I think, in the tournament, why Gongba's lack of ability to play heavy minutes in the tournament did end up hurting the Blue Devils in this tournament. So I think defensively, I have a little bit of concern for Boozer at the next level being something more than just average.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So like he just feels to me like a guy that I know is going to be good at the NBA level, but how good is I don't foresee him, you know, taking the league by storm. And you hit the nail on the head. Like when you watch Darren Peterson at his best, I mean, it's crazy. You're on the edge of your seat. You're like blown away by how good he is and how easy the game feels for him. And same thing with DeBonta, like his physical tools and just how easy he can get to the rim and or stop on a dime and hit like a turnaround fadeaway mid-range shot. And I don't really feel that with Boozer, but I do think that like his offensive his offensive package as a whole, like I think him being versatile enough, I trust that he'll figure it out. And him having the pedigree, you know, being Carlos Boozer's son and playing high level basketball his whole life and all of that. Like I know he's going to be good at the NBA level. It's just a matter of like, you know, is he going to be a franchise guy that's winning NBA championships? Probably not. Probably I don't see that being the case. And you know, the defensive problems, as great as Duke was defensively, it was weird how when things were bad for them, like you just scratch your head. They weren't perfect defensively, but the metrics said they were the best defensive team in the country. And yet like, yeah, it was for being so good, Boozer and the rest of the crew, like you could exploit them pretty easily. And Terrace Reed like had his way with a team that should, you know, on paper, it shouldn't have been that way. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
And we'll be right back after this break. Terrace Reed's had an awesome tournament. 26 points against Duke. Post-ups, kick-outs, drawing doubles. He was way too big for Boozer and Malik Brown. And Illinois, they have the brothers, the Vesich brothers. They have Mirkovich. Then Arizona has Krivas at 7'2". He's going to face off against Mara with Michigan at 7'3". Size has been a trend in this tournament, and it's also becoming a trend in the NBA as well. Size, I think, is becoming increasingly important. More teams playing with two bigs. Was that an underrated component when it came to people deciding their Final Fours, making their picks heading into March Madness this year? But I ask that because I think still in the NBA, it's a bit underrated that people are overlooking the importance of just being big and having two bigs on the floor. It's one of the reasons why I chose Illinois to go to the Final Four, just to be frank. I think the brothers and Mirkovich are so good.
Yeah, I think you're onto something, because the 4-1 seeds, even when you look at that, and like this regular season of college basketball was dominated by Duke and Michigan and Arizona. They were the three best at the top. Florida kind of came on late. Florida lost a lot of games early, and they were sort of figuring it out. And then they, through the SEC season, they just ripped through and were destroying everybody. But if you look at all four of those teams, you look at the profile, all four of those teams, you want to throw UConn in there, and obviously Illinois now that they are in the Final Four. All of them are, the strength is their front court, every single one of them. Now, the Arizona, Jaden Bradley wins Big 12 Player of the Year. But if you watch Arizona basketball, they don't shoot a ton of threes. They have, like, Toby Awaka comes off the bench, and he's a bruiser, and he would start for 99% of college basketball teams. And he's just an incredible sixth man. And Koa Pete and Krivas, and even, like, Karchenkov's, like, a big bruising, like, wing guy that, like, wants to get to the rim. So Arizona, you know, like Arizona has good guard play. Don't get me wrong, but like the reason Arizona is here is because of the strength of their front court. The reason Michigan is here and the reason Michigan's been so good is the strength of their front court. Yaxel Lindeborg, Moraes Johnson, Ade Mara as a rim protector. So yeah, and then Duke obviously with Boozer and Gongba goes out and Duke isn't quite as good and Gongba comes back and they look a little bit better and that's not a coincidence. So yeah, I think like there was a fascination with guard play for a very long time and for good reason. And the 3-point shot has become obviously the thing that everybody turns to and says like, that's how you have to win basketball games. But this is one of the reasons I find college basketball so fascinating is because, styles change quickly and different things you can win in at the college level a million different ways. And it sort of shifts year to year as to what it's going to take to win a national championship. And I think this is the first year where I really, really felt that, where I looked around and I was like, damn, some of the best teams in this country are dominated by big guys. And we haven't had that in a very long time. It has been a guard dominated game. And you think like last year, Florida was the national champion. Florida had a great front court. They had a great front court this year. Florida won a national championship because of their guard play. They won because Walter Clayton Jr. went nuclear in March. So yeah, I do think that you're onto something there, but I still like in the back of my mind, I'm curious, world guard play went out. Well, ultimately, which of these four teams has the guards that step up? Will that be the difference as to who wins the national championship?
Which team do you think that is of these four? Who does have that edge with guard play?
I think Arizona does, and that's why I've thought Arizona is the best team in the country all year. Like when you're splitting hairs between Duke, Michigan, and Arizona, I've always given the edge to Arizona because of Burries and Bradley. I think that defensively they're great. But also offensively, both of those guys are guys that you can give the ball to and say, go get us a bucket, you know? But Keaton Wagler at Illinois, I mean, he's probably the best player left in this tournament. See, he's the best. If you're looking for a guy that fits that profile of like, let's give him the ball, let's clear out, let's let him carry us. Illinois has all sorts of weapons. Illinois is the best offense left in this tournament and probably just the best offense in general in all of college basketball. But I don't mean to say that it's Wagler and everybody else, but if that's something that excites you as a basketball fan, is the idea of guys who could do that in the Final Four, Keaton Wagler is the guy. But as far as like what I've seen all season and consistency, I think Arizona has the best guard player.
I love everything about Keaton Wagler. I just love that guy. I don't care that he doesn't dunk. I don't care that he's not an elite athlete. The NBA has shown that you don't have to be an elite athlete. The best players in the world aren't necessarily the elite high-flying athletes. They do what he does. The step back threes, the footwork, the deceleration in the paint to get into his floater to create space for layups and kickout opportunities. Mm-hmm. He's just, as a freshman, it blows my mind, Titus, that Wagler wasn't a top 100 recruit. What are we doing? Like, what was missed with this guy at high school level?
I don't know. I don't know how this happens. This freshman class was unbelievable. There's so many good freshmen in college basketball. It's the best freshman class of all time. And Wagler, who is now the last. Now, Arizona has freshmen. Trey McKinney at Michigan is very good. And obviously, Braylon Mullins hits the big shot. He starts for UConn. But as you're looking at the Final Four, and this was the year of the freshmen, the one freshman who's just a super, super duper star was Keaton Wagler. He's the one guy left, and he was the guy that no one saw coming. And I don't know how this happens. I don't know who we should blame. The recruiting gurus got this one wrong, or if Brad Underwood's just that good of a recruiter or that good of a coach. But yeah, you know what's fascinating about Keaton Wagler is that he's got a bunch of teammates that are European, and I sort of feel like he's almost. He should be European. Like the way he plays the game, I almost feel like if he was European, people would love him more as you're forecasting NBA draft and all that. Cause like the way he plays, like you said, it's not an overwhelming athletic profile. He's not blowing by guys with a quick first step and then dunking on them. He's very calculated. He's always under control. He knows what shots he's capable of making, and he gets to the spots and hits the shots, and he can finish at all three levels. But he does kind of play like a European style of basketball. And I do wonder if he had one of his teammates' last names and he was coming out of like Lithuania or something. I was like, the NBA people would be like, you might have to take this guy number one. But the fact that he's an American who was like under-recruited and lightly, you know, like wasn't high on recruiting rankings, it just kind of gives you pause a little bit. And it shouldn't. I mean, if you watch him play, he's like the game at Purdue, He set a Mackey Arena record for Mackey Arena's been standing for 10,000 years, and he steps in as a freshman, and just he had 40. I think it was 43 points. That's never happened ever. No opponent's ever had that many points. It's an impossible place to play, and he just was cool, calm, and collected. He's been that way basically all season, and now Illinois is in the Final Four, and they are by seed the worst team, quote unquote. But anybody that thinks Illinois doesn't have a chance at this thing to finish the job and win two more in Indy, you haven't been paying attention to Illinois and you haven't been paying attention to Keaton Wagler.
I was talking to an NBA GM recently on the phone, and I said to him, are we sure Keaton Wagler's not like the third or fourth best player in this draft class? And he kind of got quiet and sort of changed the subject, kind of just avoided the comment. And that's either A, he thinks I'm a fool, or B, he agrees and just doesn't want that to be a conversation. It's one of the
doesn't
two.
Want anybody else that, to that, doesn't want anybody else yeah. to see what he sees. Yeah,
exactly. One of the two things. I'm not sure which one it is. I don't think it's that he thinks I'm a fool. I think that he thinks I actually agree, because the fact is he just doesn't make mistakes. We saw what happened with Tyrese Halliburton. He was underdrafted because people worried about the athletic profile. And with Keaton Wagler, his IQ is off the charts. The feel for the game is off the charts. An elite shooter. I'm not worried about the fact he doesn't dunk. He still gets where he wants to on the court. And he's part of the reason why this Illinois team is in the Final Four. And I think your point about the background, if he were a European player, not even playing college basketball, but just like an international player, putting up these types of performances, some of the 40 plus games he's had, the breakout high scoring games, he might do that in the Final Four. We'll see. I think the conversation about him would be more like, well, wait a minute, are we sure it should be a college player going number one and not this guy from Germany or Italy or Spain, whatever it is? I really do think that would be a factor. The mystery. There's a mystery to international prospects that college players just don't have.
I agree with you, and I think there's like a bias built in that Keaton Wagler has played against all these other freshmen for his entire life on AAU circuits and everything else, and there's probably a bias of like there's a reason he was not highly rated on the recruiting boards, but who cares? We're here. He's incredible. He's awesome. So, yeah.
So Keaton Wagler was a type of guy who I think people expected to not be a one and done, to not be a potential top five pick. Mm-hmm. This year, we have guys like Nate Ament, Chris Sinak, Caden Boozer, Mikel Brown, Amari Allen, a bunch of freshmen. Who of them do you think should go back for their sophomore years?
I mean, I love college basketball, so I want them all to come back. I think I'm also like a little old school where I long for the days where guys are like, I could go back and what, like Nate Ament feels like an old, like a, if this was 30 years ago, Nate Ament comes back and maybe wins National Player of the Year, you know, and then like might be.
Why would he not go back? I think the argument for him is stronger than anybody else. If he stays in this year's draft, he might go 8, but he might go 18. And next year with a weaker class, he can go number one and win National Player of the Year, go to the Final Four. Why would he not go back? I think it's a no-brainer in my eyes.
I feel that way about a lot of guys, Kevin, to be honest. But Nate Ament's a great example. It's just like it's not going to happen. I know he's not going to come back, but like I
– You don't think so? No chance?
I don't know. Like guys just want to play in the NBA and they get to this point and they know they're going to be a first round pick. You probably have someone in his ear that's like, you're going to be a top 10 pick. You're going to, you know, and like you said, he might fall in the draft, but like, are his people going to tell him that? No, he's a guy that, yeah, if he comes back, he could win National Player of the Year. He could be the number one pick. And that would not surprise me at all. He's got incredible physical tools. He can shoot the ball extremely well. I love everything about his game, but he just like didn't really put it together. I mean, the game the other day against Michigan yesterday, he just kind of MIA'd and Tennessee's getting run off the floor. And, you know, I'm not saying that like he doesn't have the mental makeup to be great, but like come back another year, fix the consistency problems. Cause he was great. There were stretches this year where he looked like a top five pick, you know? And you see why he was so highly thought of as a recruit, but he's like a perfect example of a guy that like, the idea of NIL being around, the idea of like guys don't need to run to the NBA quite as quickly anymore. He feels like a perfect example of that. And he should come back. I just know he won't. And it breaks my heart as a college basketball fan, because I would love to see what a second year looks like for him where he can, you know, he's got his legs a little bit in terms of his sea legs in college basketball, and he can be the guy and he can go into next year at Tennessee, be like, I'm going to try to average 20 plus a game. I'm going to be the number one pick. I'm going to be the National Player of the Year. Unfortunately, he's not going to do that. He's going to go to the league. He's going to be drafted 16th. He's going to play sparingly next year as a rookie. He's going to average 9 points a game, and that's going to be what Nate Ament does next year instead of being National Player of the Year.
I know. It's just a bummer. I mean, I think it's an easy decision for like an Amari Allen, Caden Boozer. Like maybe you test the waters, but you probably go back. I think Sanak at Houston, I would like to see him go back as well.
I'm with you. All these guys should come back.
Mikal Brown, up and down year. I mean, yes, you could go in the draft and maybe you're number eight, but not a guarantee. I think with Brown, he's the guy I'd maybe lean towards going, but because like if he goes back and he remains inconsistent, your stock can plummet. Whereas I think with next year's draft class is so weak, Ament just has a game where he can go back and you're likely to improve it dramatically. And I mean, look, it's not like these guys have to stay 4 years. Not everybody needs to be Yaxel Lendenborg, and his story much different, of course. He's a JUCO guy and goes to UAB and then eventually to Michigan. And it's been interesting with the Wolverines in the tournament. Opening round, they didn't need him to have a big game. But then second round, he had 25 points on 13 shots. Then against Alabama, 23 points on 12 shots. And then against Tennessee, 27 points on 19 shots. He's kind of back to his high usage that we saw last year at UAB with Yaxel Lendenborg. What's your take on his NBA potential despite being 23 years old? What do you see from Yaxel Lendenborg's NBA prospects?
He's good at everything. That's what I see. I mean, he is his numbers don't jump off the page of you if you're just checking in right now and like, you know, you go to like his basketball reference and you're like, I want to see. I've heard a lot about this guy. What's he averaging? I think like before the tournament, I don't know what his numbers are at now, but like before the tournament, he was averaging like 14 points a game. You know, he's a first team All-American, and you know, they put out the graphics of first team All-Americans, and he kind of stands out because they'd always put like points per game next to the guys, and it's 14 points. You're like, how is this guy first-team All-American averaging 14? It's because he does everything. He does everything for Michigan. He rebounds the ball. He'll guard 1 through 5. He is truly a Swiss Army knife, and they call him Dominican LeBron, I think. And that's kind of, I mean, it feels like, I mean, when you watch him play, that is kind of, obviously, I'm not comparing him to LeBron at the next level. I'm just saying that, like, he has that feel of at any given game, he can morph into whatever Michigan needs from him. That's kind of been how he's been all year. And now Michigan's offense if you're looking to pick nits with Michigan, like their offense at times has been clunky, and their offense, you know, 3-point shooting at times, in their losses especially, you point at that and you're like, see, that's going to get them in March. That's going to be a problem. But their offense has been incredible lately. And it's because, like you said, I think it's because they're playing through Yaxel more. His shooting numbers have been great lately. Every time he shoots a three, I think that's the defense. Every time Yaxel Lindeborg is open for three right now, I think the defense is saying to themselves, that's exactly what we want. And then they watch the three go in and they're like, never mind. And that's kind of been the story with him. Is that the only way to really stop him is to make him shoot threes. And he's hitting threes. And when he's hitting those, and he's rebounding the ball. And again, like he's, you know, against Purdue, they're throwing him on Braden Smith, a 6-foot guard, but then he'll also like bang down low and grab rebounds. And he can guard any position. I love him. I don't know how it's going to translate to the next level. I know his age is a problem, but he's got such a high basketball IQ, and he can do everything. He's been a joy to watch this year.
Well, ever since he really hit the go-ahead three-pointer against Wisconsin after they almost blew that, he's been feeling really good from three-point range. I think to your point, I know he's 23 years old, and the history of guys that are 23 or 24 years old as NBA rookies isn't great. As lottery picks or top 20 guys, but his story, his background is just so different. JUCO, and then, you know, what was his senior year of high school, he didn't have good enough grades. Like, he's just got an interesting background that I think with him, he's just in a different category as a late bloomer. And at the least, I think he's going to be a really good, versatile NBA role player. I have no doubts about that. And the test for Michigan against Arizona is going to be real, though, because I agree with you. You know, Arizona's got size. They got bulk at the wing and forward position. Like, it's going to be tough for Yaxel to have a massive game. And then the guard play for Arizona. Dude, Braden Burries, I love that dude so much. The dive on the floor, laying out, up 13 points. Like, dude just has that type of winning mentality on the defensive end. He makes plays offensively. I picked Michigan to go to the final. I'm not so sure. After just watching Arizona throughout this entire tournament, I think it's going to be a hell of a game between these two.
This is This is the most excited I think I've ever been for a Final Four game. I'd have to think about it, though.
Really? Wow.
I'd have to sit down and make my list, because these two teams have been so good and so fun to watch all year. Now, there have been other, like one that comes to mind, when Baylor and Gonzaga played in the national championship in 2021, those were the two obviously best teams in it. Like, it was, they were head and shoulders better than everybody. That was a highly anticipated game. And then Baylor, it was over by the first media timeout. Baylor was just so much better. But yeah, I am so excited, because I think that both of these teams have been like a little, they're both like ranked high enough in the preseason. I think Michigan was higher than Arizona, but I think it's that they were both like a nice surprise for me. I think like Michigan coming into the year, they obviously hit the transfer portal big and had all these great pieces, and on paper it jumped off the page at you. But you're curious to see how the pieces fit, and you're curious, like, can Yaxel Lindeborg and Morez Johnson and Dave Mara, can they really play on the court together? How is that going to work? And where's the shooting going to come from? Elliot Cadeau coming from North Carolina, that was the knock on him. Carolina fans, like, honestly, when he decided to transfer, I don't even know if Carolina fans were that upset, because they're like, I've seen this guy do nothing but brick wide open threes for us. Get him out of here. Now Elliot Cadeau can't miss from three. I was curious to see how the pieces would fit. And then the way they fit together, the way, like, in November, they go out to Vegas and they beat Gonzaga by 40. They just go on a tear where they're beating everybody by 1,000 points. They look like the greatest team of all time, except they're not even the greatest. They might not even be the greatest team this year, because Arizona is also ripping through like an incredible non-conference schedule. They win at UConn. They beat Florida the first game of the year. And then they play in the Big 12. They lose two games. One of them, Koa Pete's hurt. The other one was at Allen Fieldhouse on Big Monday, which is Bill Self has literally never lost. If Arizona finishes the job, they will have had one of the greatest seasons we've ever seen in college basketball. I think this Michigan team is on a different level in terms of like at good teams that you see in college basketball. So I truly have no idea what to expect too. That's the other part that makes it so fascinating, is if you've only watched Michigan basketball this year, you can't imagine a world where any team can keep it close against Michigan in this tournament. If you've only watched Arizona basketball this year, you can't imagine a world where Arizona doesn't just cruise to the title, and now we're going to play each other. It's the matchup that anybody that's been watching college all season has been waiting for, and now it's happening at almost the biggest stage. I don't want them to ever implement a reseeding process, but on special occasions like this, I wish they would. I wish there was a way that this was for the national championship, Arizona and Michigan.
Are you heading home to Indiana for the Final Four?
I am. I will be there. I will be in Indy all week.
I'm excited.
Yeah, you're going?
You're going all week. Yeah, I'm going, yeah. I'm heading out this weekend.
Yes.
I'm fired up. I'm so stoked.
Hell yes.
You're going the whole week.
Yeah,
you're
dude.
The whole week out there. Nice.
We're going Wednesday, I think we're going to get there. Okay. Or Thursday, something like that. But we'll be there. And then I'm staying through Monday to the championship game, which a lot of people leave Saturday after the game. But, yeah, we're staying through the championship.
I'm staying through Monday. It's an awesome time. I'm fired up, man. It's going to be my first time in Indiana. Where should I go? I'm dropping weight. I'm getting the healthiest I've ever been. I'm on my way. What's like the healthy restaurant with like good stuff for me?
Going to the wrong city, buddy.
Well,
you're going
I'll
to the
just,
wrong
I'll,
city.
I'll guess I'll just eat at Sweetgreen every day. I saw they have one.
I didn't realize. I didn't know they even had Sweetgreen. I didn't know. I think salad made its way to Indiana, and I think 2012. I think that was the first time salad. I remember it because my mom called me. She was like, "Mark, you're not going to believe it." I was like, "What? What's going on, Mom?" She's like, "There's this green thing that we had on our plate at dinner." It was 2012, I believe. That was the first time salad made its way to Indiana. No, a lot of great steakhouses. Indy, the joy of a Final Four at Indy. I'm obviously biased. I was born in Indianapolis. I was raised in Central Indiana my whole life. The joy of a Final Four in Indianapolis, one, everything's walkable. So you get downtown, you know, there's a buzz in the city, and you can walk everywhere, and you're walking to the stadium and walking around to like the fan fest type stuff. Everybody's just in a little condensed area. But two, the reason they keep going back to Indy for Final Fours is that the people of Indiana truly do love basketball more than anything in the world. And what you'll find, and I hope you do find this, Kevin, that yes, there will be a lot of UConn, Illinois, and Michigan and Arizona fans there. There will also be a lot of locals that are like IU fans or Purdue fans or Butler fans, or maybe they're not even like a college basketball fan necessarily, but they will be locked in on the Final Four. Your Uber drivers, you'll be able to talk ball with, you know, and they don't, they won't really care who wins, but they'll be able to talk ball and they will have watched the entire tournament. Your waitresses, your bartenders, like everybody in that city is locked in. And that's what I love about it. And that's what makes Indiana so special. And it's cool that the Indiana kid, Braylon Mullins, Mr. Basketball in the state of Indiana, hits the big shot, gets to go back home and play in a Final Four very, very close to his hometown. So there's that storyline as well.
Mark, thank you so much for joining me today, man. People can check you out. Mostly hoops, mostly sports over on YouTube with Barstool. Thank you, man. Glad things are going good with you. Can't wait to see
this.
You.
I love this. Yeah, I got to see you, man. We got to get a beer together. I appreciate you having me on, Kev, and I can't wait for this Final Four, man.
Can't wait. Have a good one, Titus. Thanks for joining me. Big thank you to Mark Titus for joining me in today's episode. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. Thanks to Emmy and the team for producing today's episode. We'll be back again on Thursday with a loaded NBA episode. Have a good week, everybody.